Before we take the supper together, we're going to be talking about an obscure Old Testament character because the book of Hebrews makes a big deal about him. So open your Bibles to Genesis 14 to begin with. We're going to spend time in Genesis 14, and then we're going to go to Hebrews and spend the rest of our time there, mostly in chapter 7. Genesis chapter 14. This is a really interesting chapter in the Bible because the first part of it is the breakout of a mini world war. You have four kings against five kings, and they duke it out, and it becomes relevant to the Bible story because Lot, Abraham's nephew, is caught in the middle of all this. In the scope of the war, he gets captured along with other people, and Abraham has to take on the role of a general, which is usually not a role that we see Abraham playing in Genesis, but he marshals his 318 guys, and he goes off, and he fights the people who captured his nephew and his nephew's stuff, and he beats them in battle, and he carries Lot and all of his possessions back home to Canaan before actually chasing these guys all the way up to Syria. So he was wildly successful in the one battle that he ever fought, we're told about in the scriptures. And on the way back, as he gets back to Canaan, he goes into a place that the scriptures call the Valley of the Kings, or the King's Valley, which most people think is a place right outside of where ancient Jerusalem was. And he meets the king of Sodom there. But he doesn't just meet the king of Sodom. He meets somebody else who is so evidently mighty and superior to him that he gives him, Abraham gives Melchizedek, the king of Salem, 10% of all the things that he had just received in the battle with the other kings that he had just fought. And so today, we're going to focus on this man because the Bible tells us focusing on this man helps us to focus on the Lord of all lords that we serve and that we will remember when we eat the supper together in several minutes. So let's go to Genesis 14 and let's talk about who Melchizedek was. Just notice some things about this chapter and the little bit of detail that we have, and then we'll go to Jesus in Hebrews. Verse 17 of Genesis 14, notice what it says. After his return from the defeat of Chedorlaomer and the kings who were with him, the king of Sodom went out to meet him, to meet Abraham, at the Valley of Sheba, that is the King's Valley. And Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was priest of God Most High, and he blessed him and said, "Blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who has delivered your enemies into your hand." And Abram gave him a tenth of everything. And that's really all it said about Melchizedek until you get to Psalm 110. There's a little bit mentioned about him there, and then the book of Hebrews, and that's it in the whole course of the Bible. But even in just these several verses, there's a lot to dig out. For one thing, this guy is a godly Canaanite. Did you ever think those two words would be said together in the same sentence? He's a godly Canaanite who wears multiple hats. You know, the Canaanite people in the Old Testament just had the reputation for being terrible people that God had to drive out and wipe out because their practices were horrible. You know, especially Genesis 13, verse 13 says that the men of Sodom, the men of the River Jordan Valley, were especially bad. They were wicked, great sinners against the Lord. Later on in chapter 15, as it says there in verse 16, Abraham is in the course of talking to God. God says, "Your descendants shall come back here in the fourth generation, for the iniquity of the Amorites," the Canaanite peoples, "is not yet complete." But boy, they are sliding downhill in a hurry. And so by the time you get to Moses and Joshua, Canaanite people are really bad, not just in the River Jordan Valley, but all over the place. I think it's interesting when you get to chapter 24, when it comes time for Abraham to send his servant out to get a wife for his son Isaac, he makes his servant swear, makes him put his hand on his thigh to say, "You are not going to go around here to get a local girl for my boy. You better go to Mesopotamia and get that woman from one of my relatives." And then later on, in Genesis 28, that happens in the next generation. Isaac, when he's telling Jacob, "Hey, it's time for you to get a wife," he says, "You need to go over there and marry one of your cousins. Because you are not going to marry somebody from around here." So over and over in Genesis, Canaanite girls and Canaanite people in general are not the sort of people that glorify God. And so considering all of that, it is so neat to me that smack dab in the middle of the Genesis story is a godly Canaanite who is glorifying God in the position of king, but also in the position of priest, not priest to Baal or priest to any other Canaanite god that all the rest of the Canaanites served. He's a priest of Yahweh. You see that? It specifically says he is a priest of God Most High. And then when he blesses Abram, what is in his mouth? "Blessed be Abram by God Most High. Blessed be," verse 20, "God Most High." I think it's interesting that that vocabulary gets into Abraham's mouth, because when he's talking to the king of Sodom right after that, and the king of Sodom is trying to negotiate, "Okay, the stuff, you know, I want this and you can have that." And Abraham says, "I'm not going to get anything from you because God Most High, possessor of everything, is my God, and he's got me covered. So I don't need to take anything from you." But it's so neat that this man is a king and a priest at the same time, and in a godly way. You know, that was nothing unusual to have those two roles combined together in the ancient world. Because in the way that most people looked at things back then, the king was the son of the gods. And so who better to take the role of priest than somebody who is actually descended from the gods? That's not really what it was, but that's how they thought about it. In ancient Egypt, not only was the pharaoh a priest, he was considered to be the only one capable of going to the shrines and offering the sacrifices. And so, because of time constraints, he had some other priests working with him, but he was the one. In ancient Rome, even, fast forward, hundreds and thousands of years, even in Rome, in the time of the kings were the priests. And when the Romans got rid of the monarchy and they said, "Hey, we want to be a republic, we don't want kings anymore," they even appointed a guy called the Rex Sacrum, if I'm saying that right. And that job title was King of the Sacred Rites. And so he would go in and he would perform the special duties that the kings used to do back when they had kings. And it's like they couldn't even get rid of that. It's like that's got to be here in our society. The king is a priest. That's always the way it works. And ancient Israel was the exception to this. You remember when God organized Israel back at Mount Sinai and he gave the law? He set up the priesthood. He said, "Aaron, you're it, man. All of your kids, all of your sons, those are the priests." But he made no effort to organize a kingship. There was no monarchy. Now, he wrote some things in Deuteronomy 17 about when the time comes and you all clamor for a king, here's what he's going to do. But God did not set that up. The people clamored for that during the days of Samuel. And when the king was appointed, when Samuel was anointed and crowned the first king, he was not made a priest. In fact, you remember when he tried to offer the sacrifice without Samuel there, he got in big trouble with the Lord and God said, "That's it. I'm picking a new king. I've had it with you." I think it's interesting that during the days of King Uzziah, we mentioned this in class on Wednesday night, King Uzziah, in the days when Judah and Israel were separate kingdoms, he tried to take his censer and march into Solomon's temple to offer sacrifices, and he got struck with leprosy and died a leper. And so it's very interesting to me to see a man who is a priest and king of Yahweh, and God is pleased with that. God is approving of this, and he's a good man. And notice what else is said about him in Genesis 14, in the passage that we read. He is a provider of bread and wine. I think this is so neat. Melchizedek is very much like Abraham. Abraham was a hospitable guy. You see that in Genesis 18 when the three angels come walking by Abraham's tent. Abraham runs out to meet him and he says, "Oh, you know, come sit under my tree and I'll make a feast for you. Hey, Sarah, make some bread." And, you know, that we know that story. Well, it's very much like Melchizedek here. Melchizedek, as far as we know, didn't have a dog in the fight of these four kings and five kings. That Salem was not one of the cities that was involved in the big conflict. As far as we can tell, he had nothing to do with any of this stuff. But as the king of Sodom and Abraham walk by his front gate, he's going to come out and give them supplies. And I think it's so cool, considering the Jesus connection here to what he provides them. It specifically says in verse 18, he brought out bread and wine. This is such a huge contrast from what the king of Sodom does. We didn't read down past verse 20, but the king of Sodom, instead of providing Abraham supplies, instead of being interested in Abraham's well-being, the first word out of his mouth is give. He's coming with open hands because he's only there to try to get and to try to receive what he wants from the situation. He doesn't really care. He could have said, "Hey, Abram, how was your journey down? Did you get attacked along the way? Man, you must be really tired. How about you sit over here and we'll get you some stuff?" There's none of that. There's just, "Okay, I'm here for my stuff. You can have this. I want that." And Abraham just says, "No, I'm not going to get involved in that." But what Melchizedek does here with these provisions is so very much like what we see Jesus doing right before the cross. Jesus is about to enter the most perilous, the most intense, the most suffering-laden moment of his life. Don't you think at the Lord's Supper table, Jesus could have made some demands? Jesus could have said, "Okay, y'all know what I'm about to do for you. Here's what I want to receive." But at the Lord's Supper table, he is just interested in giving, not being given to. Remember the language of what he says when he gives out the bread and the wine at the supper table? Luke chapter 22, verse 19. "He took bread when he given thanks, he broke it and gave it to them, saying, 'This is my body, which is given for you.'" And all he asks of them is to just do this, to keep eating the bread and the wine in the future in remembrance of me. In Luke chapter 22, verse 20, the very next verse, "Likewise the cup after he had eaten, saying that this cup that is poured out for you is the new covenant in my blood." And in that battle that he fought with Satan on the cross, he received so much war booty no other human has ever received before. And what did he do with that? He shared it with us. He attained the rank of king of the world. And what does he keep telling us in the gospel? We reign with him in the heavenly places. He's sharing that with us. Ephesians 4:8, "When he ascended on high, he led a host of captives and he gave gifts to men. Gifts of eternal life, salvation, righteousness, peace, you name it, we have it in Jesus. Because he is a generous God." That's what we see in Melchizedek that foreshadows the great reality of the Lord that we serve. That is so neat to me. Something else that's really neat about Melchizedek that you see here in Genesis 14 is that he is being used as God's instrument of blessing to Abraham's family. Do you remember back in chapter 12, when God first starts talking to Abraham, what does he say? He says a lot of things. He says, hey, Abraham, I'm going to make your name great, which is exactly what, in the last chapter, chapter 11, what the Tower of Babel people were trying to do. Hey, let's build this thing to make a name for ourselves. And that didn't go so well. But the very next chapter, God picks out this guy from Ur of the Chaldeans, and he says, hey, I'm going to make your name great. And so what that means is, I'm going to make of you a mighty nation. You're going to have a lot of people that are coming for you. I'm going to give you a land that your people will live in. I'm going to bless you. And he specifically says back there in chapter 12, verse 3, I will bless those who bless you. Along the scope of your life, Abraham, people are going to come alongside of you because they're coming from me, and they're going to bless you. I think this is so neat, because what do you see in chapter 14? What does Melchizedek say? Melchizedek doesn't say a whole lot here. The only lines that we've got is what he says to Abraham when he says, verse 19, 14, and he blessed him and said, blessed be Abram by God Most High, possessor of heaven and earth, and blessed be God Most High, who's delivered your enemies into your hands. God is using this man to do for him what he said back in chapter 12 was going to happen for him in his life. This idea of blessing is so significant to us. This doesn't just mean that Melchizedek is praising Abraham, or Abram, as he's called here, or that he's just saying, hey, I wish you well. You know, I'm really glad that you beat those kings, and I hope it goes well for you in the later part of your life. Now, this idea of blessing in the Hebrew means to be filled up. To have the blessing of God is to be given a measure of success because God is putting His hand upon you in a good way. And this is so important because when we look at this, we see Jesus being used as God's instrument of blessing us. We're part of Abraham's family too in Jesus. Do you remember what Jesus would often talk about with people? Do you remember how the Sermon on the Mount begins? As he goes up there on the mountain, all these people come up to him. The very first thing out of his mouth is, blessed are the poor in spirit. They're going to be satisfied by God. Blessed are those who mourn. They're going to be comforted. Blessed are you when you get persecuted. Blessed are you when this happens to you or that happens to you. I'm going to take care of you. I'm going to enrich your life. It's not always going to be easy. Persecution, people yelling in your face, throwing you out in the dirt, taking your house and your stuff, putting you on a cross, putting you in a lion's den. It's not going to be easy, but you're going to be given filling by God. You're going to be given strength and purpose. That's what Jesus does. Right after that, in the Sermon on the Mount, after the blessed are you, when these things happen, remember there's some purpose statements. There's you are the light of the world. You are the salt of the earth. So Jesus gives us purpose and he gives us the strength to fulfill the purposes that he gives us. We have both together. And so you see an inkling of that here in Genesis 14 with this little bitty account of Melchizedek and Abraham. All right, let's continue to build. Let's go to Hebrews. So how is Melchizedek like Jesus? We talked some about that already, but we want to especially focus on the things that the Hebrew writer brings out as he is drawing a connection here between these two people. So go with me to Hebrews chapter 7. Notice the first thing that the Hebrew writer says, verses 1 and 2. Hebrews chapter 7. For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest of the Most High God, met Abraham returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, and to him Abraham appointed a tenth part of everything. He is first, by translation of his name, King of Righteousness, and then he is also King of Salem, that is, King of Peace. In the Bible, Names were very, very important and set the tone for the scope of that person's life story. You remember what Jacob's name means in Genesis? It means heel grabber, because that's what he did as he was coming out of the womb. You know, Esau's coming out, and he's like, I'm catching, I'm on for the ride. That is what Jacob did for the rest of his life. He's always trying to grab people's heels and get a one-up on them. And you remember what Nabal means in the Hebrew. And when you get to Samuel and you get to Abigail and Nabal, Nabal's name means fool. And when Abigail's talking to David, as she stops him on the road as he's coming to wipe out Nabal, she says, that's his name, and that is pretty much what he is like. That is who he is. So your identity is often matched up to what you were called. I think it's interesting what Melchizedek's name means. And the Hebrew writer just, right here in the text, he just spells it out for us. I don't know if this name was his personal name or if it was a title like Pharaoh or like Tsar or something like that. Kings would often have those kinds of titles for their position. But his name means King Melech of Righteousness. Righteousness, I'm sure I'm butchering the Hebrew. The word righteousness in the Hebrew is Zedekah, Melchizedek. And so when you look at the kings of the past, or even the kings and the leaders of the present, it's pretty rare to see somebody who combines power and righteousness, or uprightness, isn't it? Those two things don't often coincide with each other. And that wasn't always true for Salem, the place that he is king over, because when you fast forward in Bible history, when you get to the days of Joshua, and Joshua is leading the people in, they're going to wipe out the Canaanites, they come to the city of Salem, which by that point is called Jerusalem, and the king of that place is not Melchizedek, his name is Adonizedek, which means Lord of Righteousness, but the guy was not righteous at all. In fact, he leads a coalition of four kings against Israel and Joshua's ally, Gibeon, at that time. And so that's not always true, but it was true here. We don't have a lot of details about Melchizedek, but we are confident from how he's portrayed in the Bible. He was a man who did good in his community for the people around him. And the effect of that was peace, which is what the name Salem, the Hebrew writer just flat out tells us here in the text at the end of verse 2. He's the king of Salem, that is king of peace. That's what happens when righteousness is done. Peace in the Bible doesn't just mean an absence of strife. It doesn't mean people aren't fighting with each other. Peace in a positive kind of way means harmony and wholeness, in alignment with God and His purposes. And it's interesting that these two qualities, righteousness and what comes of it, peace, are paired together in the prophets when God talks about the time of Jesus, the time of the Messiah. Isaiah chapter 9, verse 7, of the increase of His government and of peace, there will be no end. On the throne of David and over his kingdom, to establish it and uphold it with justice and with righteousness from this time forth and forevermore, the zeal of the Lord of hosts will do this. How are we going to bring peace to our families, to our personal life, to this congregation, the other Christians around us that we work with and worship with? The places that we go, the people that we see, how do we bring peace? It does not come by unrighteousness. It does not come by being the loudest voice in the room. You're going to do what I tell you to do, and then we're going to have peace. No, and it also doesn't come by avoidance. Well, I'm going to run the other way. I'm not going to engage with you, and then we'll have peace, because we don't know each other very well, and there's nothing to be conflicted about. You know, peace comes by doing good in God's way. And that's what the Prince of Peace would do. Later on in Isaiah, it said about Jesus that a bruised reed he will not break, and a faintly burning wick he will not quench. He will faithfully bring for justice. God didn't avoid us. He didn't come down and intimidate us. Jesus was probably the most unintimidating Jew that you could ever meet on the street. But he was the Prince of Peace. He was the one bringing righteousness. And look what that did for us. So Jesus is like Melchizedek in that he's a ruler with the same qualities, righteousness and peace. See that in 1 and 2. Something else you see about him is in verse 3. Look at verse 3 with me. He is, talking about Melchizedek, he is without father or mother or genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but resembling the Son of God, he continues a priest forever. So verse 3 might sound kind of confusing on the surface. Does this mean that Melchizedek is some sort of a supernatural being, and he wasn't born, and he never died, and he didn't have a mom, and he didn't have a dad? That's what a lot of Jews thought about him. Some Jews said, well, this must be like Shem, like Noah's son. Or this must be like Michael the archangel. All kinds of weird ideas have come out of Genesis 14 that just really don't make a lot of sense. But this verse is talking about the kind of priesthood Melchizedek had, not so much about the guy himself. What was his priesthood like? Well, under the Israelite law, how can you get to be a priest? You can only be a priest if you can say, hey, I'm looking up my family tree, and oh, there's Aaron! And if you couldn't do that, you were excluded. You remember in Ezra chapter 2, we were studying that not too long ago, several months back. In Ezra 2:62, there were a group of guys who tried to serve as priests, but they looked at the records and they could not find a connection back to Aaron. And so they were put out of that position until they could prove that at a later point in time. So genealogy was everything. You had to have the proper ancestry in order to do this job under the Levitical law. But Melchizedek, how was he a priest? He wasn't a priest because he came from a long chain of people that had the right credentials and the right family lineage. He didn't follow a previous priest, and he didn't leave his position to somebody else after him. No, he was a priest, and it kind of began and it ended with him. He was this priesthood. And that's very much like Jesus. Jesus was a priest, is a priest, and he didn't come from Aaron's family. In fact, if you look later on in Hebrews 7, Hebrew writer is going to say in verse 14, it's evident that our Lord was descended from Judah. And in connect, because remember, he's a son of David. David's a Judah guy. He's descended from Judah. And in connection with that tribe, Moses said nothing about priests. He didn't come from that family at all. He's not even a Levite. So he, look at verse 16, how is he a priest then? He's become a priest in the likeness of Melchizedek, not on the basis of a legal requirement concerning bodily descent, but by the power of an indestructible life. So Jesus is the sole possessor, the sole person in his spot, in his role, of his priesthood, like Melchizedek. And along those lines, in the same kind of vein, he holds that priesthood permanently. That's the end of verse 3. You see that? Resembling the Son of God, he continues a priest forever. Psalm 110, we didn't really talk about Psalm 110 much here, but Psalm 110 is the only other place in the Bible that mentions Melchizedek. And in that place, it says about Jesus, you are a priest forever, according to the order of Melchizedek. And so Melchizedek was a priest forever, not in the sense that he never died. Some people think that about him. But no, in the sense that he never picked up this job from anybody else, and he never gave that job to anybody else. And that's what Jesus is like for us. Because of his resurrection, the power of his indestructible life he is never going to die again. He always retains that mediating position between you and me and the God that we serve. He's always available for us. That's pretty different from what we're used to with human leadership. Especially as Americans, we pride ourselves on the ability to go to the ballot box and get rid of somebody if we want to get rid of them. It requires enough of us to think that. But you know, that's our society and our culture, is we get a president and 4 years go by and we're going to decide if we want him to keep serving in the Oval Office or not. And members of Congress, then Supreme Court, a little bit different. You got lifetime appointments, but even then, people die off. Or people retire, like Justice Breyer had just announced his retirement, and somebody else is going to sit on the bench in his spot. There's a constant turnover of human leadership, no matter who it is, no matter how much you like them, how much you hate them. Regardless, they're not going to be there forever. That is different with Jesus Christ. He is always there for you. So this is how I want to end things. We got to ask ourselves the question of, why does this matter so much to the writer of the book of Hebrews? Why does he spend so much time unpacking this obscure Bible story back in the book of Genesis? Well, he tells us why he does this. Look back in chapter 6. Actually, I'm going to start talking about chapter 5 and look at chapter 5. Chapter 5, verse 8. He's talking about Jesus. He was a son. He learned obedience through what he suffered. And being made perfect, he's the source of eternal salvation. Verse 10. Being designated by God a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. So the Melchizedek discussion starts all the way back here in this chapter. But then starting in verse 11, the Hebrew writer slams on the brakes. And he takes a huge step back in the letter and he says, okay, y'all, I've got a lot that I want to say about this guy and about what he means for us. But you can't handle it because you're immature Christians. And you need milk. Even after you've been believers all this time, you can't handle the meat. And you need to go back and talk about baptism and repentance and laying on of hands and the resurrection and the final judgment and all these foundational first principle things. Those are good to talk about. Those are good to get a grasp on. But he says, you guys got to build on top of that. Don't keep talking about that stuff. Go on to maturity. And Melchizedek and this whole priesthood and Jesus thing is the meat that he's trying to point them towards. And so he's got this huge part of the letter. Well, he will just say, you guys got to grow. Because if you don't grow, you can't appreciate what I'm saying to you. But then he will go back to Melchizedek, starting there about verse 1 of chapter 7. But even before that, look with me in chapter 6. So chapter 6, look at how he casts a vision of God's purposes, his expectations for them. Verse 11 of chapter 6, we desire each one of you to show the same earnestness, to have the full assurance of hope until the end, so that you may not be sluggish, but imitators of those who through faith and patience inherit the promises. He's going to spend all chapter 11, on people who did that. But right now, he's just going to lay it out there and say, this is what we want for you. Don't be sluggish. Now, can you relate to this? You ever reach points in your life where you do feel sluggish, like these Christians that he's talking to were? Where you don't feel like having faith and patience. And the promises that you read about in the New Testament and the rest of the Bible, they just seem so far off. You don't know when it's going to happen. And you don't really feel like putting one more step in front of the other one. I think, if we're honest, all of us reach times where we feel like that. And the last couple of years, in a lot of ways, have been a test of whether we are going to become sluggish Christians or not. So what's going to motivate us? What's going to help us to climb, as C.S. Lewis says in the Narnia books, further up and further in? I think this is really the key to all of that. If we wait for the world to stabilize, we're going to be waiting a really long, long time. Because the world is always going to be a collection of shifting sands. There's always going to be somebody upset on the TV as you turn on Fox or CNN because they want to get you upset so that you will keep watching their programs and giving them more ratings. In terms of our personal lives, in terms of our family situations, our jobs, our finances, our congregation, whatever it might be, not everything is just going to stabilize in the way that we would like it to be. So what do we do when that happens? What do we focus on? Let's keep reading together. Look at verse 17, and these are the verses on the screen that gets to this point of the fervency of our faith depends on how much we understand Jesus' priesthood. Look what he says. When God desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of the promise of what, by the way? Well, that connects back to chapter 4, the promise of Abraham's family, a land of Sabbath rest, the promised land. When he desired to show more convincingly to the heirs of that promise the unchangeable character of his purpose, he guaranteed it with an oath, so that by two unchangeable things in which it is impossible for God to lie, we who have fled for refuge, I love the language of this, we who have fled for refuge might have strong encouragement to hold fast to the hope set before us. We have this as a sure and steadfast anchor of the soul, a hope that enters into the inner place behind the curtain, where Jesus has gone as a forerunner on our behalf, having become a high priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. You see how he ties all of that right into this thread of thought? The more we think about this, and the more that it seeps into our minds and our souls, the more it's not going to matter what's going on with COVID, or what's going on with our jobs, or what's going on with our families, what's going on with all the things that might go wrong in a lot of ways. Because Jesus forever reigns as our king as well as our priest. And notice this. Notice how permanent this is. Verse 18, the Hebrew writer says, it's not just one, it's two unchangeable things that God did to help us understand that his presence and his power in our lives is never going away. We can leave him, but he will never leave us. His oath and his promise that there's a land of rest coming. The world is so changeable. The world is anything but what we just read about God. If we just wanted to make a list of all of the medical announcements about COVID put out by Fauci and other government leaders that have changed and have been tweaked as these 2 years have gone by, it would be quite the list. And that's just about COVID. Our God is different. Our Lord is different. Let's understand this as much as we can. Let's think about it. Let's pray about it. Let's let it seep into us. I want to end with chapter 7, 25 through 28. Consequently, he is able to save to the uttermost those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives, priest forever, always lives to make intercession for them. For it was indeed fitting that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, unstained, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. He has no need, like those high priests under the Levite law, to offer sacrifices daily, first for his own sins and then for those of the people, since he did this once for all when he offered up himself. For the law appoints men in their weakness as high priests, but the word of the oath, which came later than the law, appoints a son who has been made perfect forever. With that in mind, let's eat the supper.